Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much. So the reason I say that is we do stream all of our events, so our conversation tonight is going out on our Facebook and our YouTube channels, and it's being recorded, and it will turn into a podcast, and we have just nudged 270,000 downloads for our podcast. I know. So there is more than one way, sorry, grammar police, to experience our events, but if you know anybody that's sad they couldn't come tonight, you can direct them towards either our Facebook or YouTube or the podcast. So anyway, welcome virtual audience. Welcome all of you. Do we want to take the obligatory picture where they hand out? Yes. Right. So what we're going to ask you to do is hold up your book and look cheerful.
Yes. I like the fact that we now make all of you work.
Yes, that's right.
All right, people with two books get bonus points.
Nice, everyone. You're such a great... You are the most social media-worthy audience I've ever had.
I love it.
All right,
I'm
going to
turn my phone off.
Oh, you all look stunning. Let me just tell you, we've all lost 20 pounds, 20 years. It's the book. I think it's holding the book, yeah.
Speaking of losing, you know, you are in fabulous shape. Your year of traveling and not writing. Isabella's always fabulous, but you are too. But I think both of you are particularly fabulous this evening. You have to actually use that. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry.
Turned on. Is it on? Yep. All right. Hold it up. Then we're in good shape. Right. So today is actually the publication day for Still See You Everywhere, and also for Isabella's book, A Forgotten Hill. Well, we sort of nudged it slightly. It probably officially isn't out for a few more days, but her publisher was so interested in having us sell it, they sent all the books to Isabella with a shipping label for us. But instead, she brought them along in her car, which I really appreciate. So anyway, they are going to have a dynamic program talking to each other. And I want to thank you all very much for your kind attention. I'm just going to sit over here.
Thank you, Barbara.
Right? Yeah. I know.
This works out well because actually we both read each other's books.
Yes.
And so this is perfect.
See, I always think this is interesting, Isabella. Shall we let them in on our secret?
Okay.
People think, for some reason, I don't know why, that authors must be adversarial. That we're secretly plotting against each other, or we want our book to sell at the expense of other books. And I will tell you, speaking for the thriller writers, you totally want to hang out with us. We, one, are the cool people at the bar. We do know how to help you hide a body. So and we love each other. Come on, other people with voices in their head telling them to kill. We are soulmates. We were always meant to be together.
And as a matter of fact, in that vein, I've been teasing Lisa. She doesn't know what this is. I told her I have a little tiny gift for her.
I'm a little afraid.
I know. You should be afraid.
I'm afraid.
But actually, I'm going to give it to her. Right. I said, you know, I'm going to wait till we start, and I'm going to give this to you.
Oh, dear God, I'm
And
really
I'm
going to
see if she knows what this is, but it's actually something we both have in common, or at least our characters do. Do you recognize that?
Oh, yes, I love this.
Okay, explain what it is. You've never
All
seen
right.
it. Explain what that is.
We will keep it up as a visual aid when we have the book signing. It is a tactical hair clip.
They what every woman needs.
For sale, yes. You can. Frankie uses one very efficiently, and before she disappeared, you can saw through things, you can measure things, you can, you know... I don't know if you could actually kill someone with you, but I think it would be fun to try. Yeah, let's say you can. But, you know, for $4.99, a little built-in security. I was thinking of the Victorian times when they had all those great things stuck in their hair and the hat pins. And think all the Victorian mysteries, they pull out the hat pin and they kill the person. Well, okay, we're not quite Victorian hat pins, but...
Well, you can even go back further to the Elizabethan era, and the women had these rings with poison in them.
Yes, the poison rings.
See, the women, they're always the more deadly, right?
Mm.
So, but the reason I particularly love that is when I was reading about Frankie Elkin, and I heard, you know, when I was reading it, she has a tactical hair clip. I'm like, OMG. So my character has a tactical hair clip. And in A Killer's Game, the first, this is the second one in the series, but the first one, she deploys her tactical hair clip. So I'm like, okay, how weird is it that we both have chosen this particular piece? So that's when I decided I was going to spring this on her as a surprise tonight.
Best kind of gift. We'll see till TSA takes away from me. When I'm arrested tomorrow going to Chicago, yeah. We're going to have words.
So it's launch day for you. Mm-hmm. So I guess we should start with you because technically I'm really a few days behind. So let's start with Frankie. So when you were writing, this is book three, and all of you all had to wait with bated breath to find out what happened. And I did too, because, you know, I read book one and book two, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, what is Frankie going to get up to? And then, you know, just starting in the very opening chapter, you start off with a huge bang. We have someone on death row. What on earth made you think of that?
Well, you know, when you walk around the world and you think of things like the beautiful butcher, you just got to do something with that. It's interesting on death row, the cases that come through. And a couple years ago, it was in a lot of headlines, and my books are absolutely influenced very much by contemporary news. There was a big case in Texas of a mother who was due to be executed in almost like 7 years. And it's like, who gets executed in 7 years? Most of these people, it's like 40 years later, and there's a bit to do. Was justice being done? Had it being served? And I think in the end, there was a lot of doubt whether she'd even, that possibly her child had died from natural causes. And I'm not sure the end result of that, but it gets you thinking about these things, you know, to the extent that this is the kind of stuff we think about. I was also reading possibly a lot about serial killers. And we all think of serial killers as being male. You know, I'm from Oregon. Ted Bundy, when I was growing up, was a little bit influential in a weird sort of way. But one of the bigger serial killers, or more significant serial killers, was way back in the day now, a female count. I mean, let me put it to you this way. Bathing in virgin blood was part of her beauty routine. Yeah, and I mean, they attribute her with hundreds of people. And it, you know, it kind of makes you wonder, you know. And so read Still See You Everywhere, and you can learn more about the care and feeding of pigs. That's all I got to tell you.
You would be the first one to write about pigs being an effective disposal method.
Yes, yes, yeah. But they don't like teeth. Just remember that. Sorry, in case you're,
Those don't digest very well. No. Nor do they cremate very well.
That's true.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems with teeth.
Yeah, I once spent time with a cadaver search dog team. Actually, one of the things they use for training is they'll go to dentists and try to get teeth. Because it's a little illegal to actually bury body parts, in case you ever wondered about this. But teeth, you know, even your kid's baby teeth or whatever, and that works. That is something the dogs will hit on. What's the weirdest thing you've researched? And you've worked. I mean, okay, let's give some credit here. You know, Isabella was in law enforcement for 20 years, so all the stuff I have to go look up and figure out, she actually kind of did. But other than that, we're totally same.
Except for that minor, minor detail. And actually, my last gig, I was commander of special investigations and forensics. So yeah, clearly, you know, some ick going on. Actually, you know what? I'll give you a quick tip.
Yeah.
Vicks Vapor Rub under the nose. Yeah. If you ever get around a scene.
Okay.
Okay. There's a technical term. The body is ripe. Vicks Vapor Rub. It helps. The guys used to smoke stogies, but they don't allow that at crime scenes anymore because it contaminates the crime scenes. But way back in the day, you would see the old detectives, like, literally with a stogie. That wasn't just a TV thing. They would literally do that to try to combat
interesting. So that's where that comes from.
That's where that it actually comes from, a real place. But they just can't do it anymore. Yeah, too much. Now you got to have, like, gowned up and... That's another thing, too. I use a term like gowned up, and some of my editors are like, what does that mean? I'm like, well, I thought everyone knew. That's like, you know, head to toe with the Tevlar suit. No, apparently, everybody doesn't.
It's not ballroom apparel.
No.
We're not talking red carpet.
I didn't know that. But, yeah, so it's just a matter of finding out what it is that is interesting and what you want to use at a particular crime scene. And I like to keep it as close to reality as I possibly can. So yeah, yeah, it tends to be a little dark and edgy.
Which is why I like the book so much.
So when you were, now I have to ask you, so when you were writing this particular Frankie, now it's kind of interesting in this situation you have sort of an anti-hero, don't you? With the beautiful butcher, because in a way you kind of managed to evoke a little bit of sympathy for her, even though she's killed, well, let's say a whole bunch of people.
Happily.
But, yeah.
Unrepentantly.
Yeah. And she's like proud of it. But yet you do. You wrote it so beautifully that you really feel for her and what she was going through. And I guess I was curious about, you know, because I wrote an anti-hero too, but I'm kind of curious to know, like, your take on taking someone who's done hideous things but making them relatable.
So it's interesting when you research, like way back in the day, I started my career writing about FBI profilers. So it was researching serial killers and criminology all the time, which actually is what I loved. I'm going to guess pretty much everyone in here, possibly you write, you watch a lot of cop shows, possibly true crime TV is on all the time. Possibly if a serial killer broke into your house tomorrow, you would stop, interview them first and say, no, 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 I understand the research differently than that. You are doing this wrong. But when I started out, one of the big thoughts behind it all was one of the reasons we see so many male serial killers is men have a tendency to externalize rage and pain. So they will project it, create a proxy or a surrogate figure. Say, so someone who is like angry at their mom will kill other women over and over again in lieu of their mother. Women, on the other hand, have a tendency to internalize. So we become alcoholics, self-destructive, bulimics, cutting, things like that. However, it's been one of these interesting things too, because I started out 30 years ago, as gender roles have become more balanced and equal. And I'm very curious actually about your take on this too, Isabella. You know, when I was doing research on gangs, like I think it was 3 years ago for the first Frankie Elkin book, they were like, oh God, in Boston. They're like, no, 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 no. You may not talk to, do not talk to female gangbangers. Do not approach them. They're way, way worse than the men. That equal opportunity extends also to violence and murder and mayhem. But I think one of the tricks with the beautiful butcher is for all of her ego and kind of her grandiose, yes, I am a monster and you will love me for it. The truth is she's a woman in a great deal of pain. And part of this pain has to do with the one person in the entire world she has ever loved was her baby sister, who was disappeared, probably kidnapped 15 years ago. And so that is Frankie's mission. You know, I have 3 weeks before I'm executed. I just got a note. It's proof she's still alive. Just find my baby sister. That's the only thing I want to know before I die, is that she is safe. I think that's a goal that's relatable to a lot of us. So you can hate who she is, you can hate who she does, what she did, but you can identify with all of us, even serial killers. There's something out there, someone out there that actually does matter to them.
Yeah, and that's something, actually, we were talking about this. We were just out together socializing, and we were talking about, you know, the different points of view and whatever. And I write from multiple points of view, which is different. And one of the things I like to do is I write from the killer's point of view every single time. Now, part of that is because having arrested a lot of people and having interviewed a lot of people, you kind of learn how the criminal mind works. And one thing I've learned is that everybody is the hero of their own story.
Yes, exactly.
And that is so true. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I totally tap into that. And, you know, the fan mail that I've gotten and stuff, you know, people are like, we love that we see the criminal's point of view, the bad guy's point of view. Well, he's not the bad guy in his mind, but it's like I can so relate. And that is something that you do learn in law enforcement. When you're going to go do an interview with somebody, the idea is to try to get a confession. And the, why do you get a confession? Well, it saves a lot of taxpayer money if you don't have an expensive trial. And then besides that, the victim is not traumatized by sitting through a horrible court, you know, where the victim ends up going on trial, which I hate. So it's just much better if you can get the person to confess what they did. And so one of the ways you have to do that, you have to sit down and you have to really connect with them. And you don't connect with them by being all judgy. It doesn't matter if you really feel that way in your mind, like you are a despicable human being and look what you did and it's horrible and I want to, you know, the whole Sipowicz, you know, with a phone book. Yeah, we don't do that. That's it's pointless because you're never going to really get a confession. So you have to connect with them no matter how despicable. So over many years, I had to learn how to put myself in their shoes. Now, granted, after I was done, it's like you run home and you take like 5 showers with lots of hot water and soap. It's just like, and I wish I could wash my brain, but you can't because you've been looking at the crime scene photos and stuff. But you have to do that in order to do it. So I use that. I figure, okay, I went through all that. I may as well use that in my book. So I do get into the bad guys and to write their point of view. But I thought that was really interesting, you know, with the way that, that you portrayed the beautiful butcher here is you didn't, you weren't really in her point of view, but you could totally understand. And she wasn't really apologizing, but it was bravado. It was all bravado. It was all surface bravado. And you could see that. But I've seen that, too, with some of the hardened criminals that you see when you arrest them and they're getting ready to, and they know they're going to go to jail. You will get that bravado sometimes. It's not real, and you know it, but I purposely don't always call them on it. I'm like, okay, they kind of need to keep this in place so that they can go and survive whatever the next 20 years or whatever they're doing. But it is a matter of sort of a kind of psychology. So I do like the idea of getting into the mind of people who perpetrate these crimes because they are human beings and they do tell themselves a story.
Yeah, so this is one of the things we have in common. So I'm a character-driven author. More so than the crime, more so than anything, it's the person that comes to me first. So I took a year off. I took a sabbatical. I'm playing with penguins in Antarctica. I'm at this Palmyra Atoll, which becomes the basis for this. I'm up in the Arctic. And then slowly but surely, there's this little, voice. I killed 18 people and it was great, in the back of my head. I mean, I really don't know what you guys think about on vacation, but this is some of the stuff I have. But as a reader, that's also what I'm looking for. I want to be in someone's shoes. I want to follow that journey. And one of the things I've loved about your books, Isabella, and it makes sense from both your training and as a writer, is that immersion into what it feels like to have this experience. And what I love about A Forgotten Kill, which is the Danny Vega series, is you get a law enforcement officer, also Danny, who's an Army Ranger, so that physicality, but her loyalty and her dedication to her family, her need to protect, I mean, it's like visceral through the pages. And then, we have Frankie wandering around the globe, la, 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 la.
No, like we talked about, Frankie is the knight errant. She wanders from town to town fixing problems, which I also love.
Yeah. Tell us about, what was your inspiration for Danny?
Well, actually,
you've written several series.
I know, I have, I've written like 3 series, but so this is the second book in the Danny Vega series. And what I wanted to do with her is I wanted to make her very different. And I thought to myself, okay, why are all the men having fun writing like Jack Reacher and, all these like really awesome tough guys? And I thought, there's women out there like that, right? There are. Well, I did my research and it turns out, and I didn't even know this, and I feel bad. I mean, as a female law enforcement officer, I should have realized how far women have gone in the military as well. And when I did my research, I learned that in 2017, the first female Army Rangers graduated from full Army Ranger school. That's like both both parts. So it's like two parts, and you have to fully graduate from both to be scrolled, which means that you're fully an Army Ranger. They do not change anything. You have to do everything the men can do. I was gobsmacked, but that was in 2017, the first time. And then in 2019 was the first time that female Army Rangers were deployed in combat. And then I think it was in 2020, the first female Ranger led a platoon of Rangers in combat. Truly remarkable. I mean, relatively recent history, but I was like blown away. I'm like, okay, I have to tell these stories. I have to come up with a character who is this kind of person, because they do exist. No one knows about them, even me. And so when doing the research, I was very inspired. And so I decided to make my character one of these female Army Rangers that was one of the first ones who came through. And then she got out, and then she became an FBI agent. There are situations, actually, there have been a history of several people who were in special forces who then joined federal agencies. So that's not unheard of either. It's actually reality. So I decided just to make it a woman. And so I thought, well, let's have a little more fun. And so I decided to go ahead and have her be a code breaker for the military, because I love codes and puzzles and riddles. And so I got to put all the codes and puzzles and riddles and have a totally kick-butt woman in charge and doing it. And I'm like, this actually could happen. And but it is fun. But I did have to put in my book, I have to explain that it's reality so people would understand.
So we were talking about this earlier. We love Reacher. We love Lee Child. We love TV, Amazon Reacher. Let's all just agree. If you haven't, you should be home binge watching that. But it's so interesting how much of the assumptions there have to do with, you know, being male. I mean, he is so strong and physical, and, you know, all problems just need the right fist, and that they're solved. And that, I would argue, very much Danny Vega represents. Mm-hmm. And then Reacher goes from town to town, and he very famously gives a quote, both in the books and in the series, that, you know, way back in caveman times, there were people who sat around the fire, and then there were people who got up and had to leave. But you know what? If you look at the westward movement, if you look at the people who came over in the Mayflower, there were women on those boats. There were women in those magazines. I mean, on those wagons. It's not just, you know, one sex that wants to wander around the world. So, you know, again, why should the men have all the fun?
See, I'm going to intervene here and say that I thought in Reacher 2, the women really were great.
Yeah, Reacher 2, the women had a lot of fun.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I was impressed at the, you know, the physicality and the mental toughness of the women, not just Reacher, who's in some ways almost a caricature, you know. If he takes his shirt off again, I don't know if I'm going to keep watching it. But anyway, there. So I also wanted to say that this is the third book in the Frankie Elkins series. How many of you have read more than one? Okay. So in the first book, I thought that you developed her as so human. You had to give an explanation for why she has self-appointed this mission that she's going on. Obviously, you know Boston well, because, you know, that's where you are, to a great degree. And I thought that you developed Frankie so well. And I wonder, for those of you who might not have read the first book, if you will find her quite the same character if you just meet her in this book. And I'm saying that because we don't have any copies of the first book, so this is not my pitch to sell them to you. But I really think this is a series where you're better off to read them in order.
So one of the things for me, because so both Isabel and I have done multiple series. So I started off my career with the FBI Profilers. Then I got known for Detective Dee Dee Warren and a vigilante, Flora Dane. And the cases of all of those characters, these are people who either by professional training or in the cases of Flora, trauma, I mean, they're kind of hardwired to take the hits. They're compartmentalized. They know how to go out, do their job, see certain things, and come home and be human again. It's all part of the training. It's all part of what they signed up for. One of the things when you start doing, Frankie for me is my first, what we would actually classify as an amateur sleuth. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have any training. She doesn't have any preparation for the things she ends up seeing and doing.
And she doesn't have any authority.
And she doesn't have any authority. But she's also, in theory, doing missing persons, not, you know, she's not Angela Lansbury, because she doesn't really like murder. She doesn't really want blood and guts. But if you've read any of the books, cases don't always go that way. So one of the things, as I go from book to book, I think it's important to be true to who she is. And again, if we're trying to walk in her shoes, this stuff leaves a mark. And
wouldn't
she has to think about that.
Yeah, wouldn't you say that because she's not official, people may more readily talk to her?
Oh, well, that's the whole
Isn't
point.
That a component of
yeah.
the series, is that she can ask questions that either for legal matters or just because law enforcement people are scary, that, you know, that people being questioned might not reveal. So I think that's really well that you inserted her into this whole, you know, missing person environment.
In the real world, we see more and more of these, of people starting to take on cold cases, partly
through
because,
podcasts, yeah.
Yeah, and the internet and all that kind of stuff. And it's not bad logic. I mean, law enforcement, because these are cold cases, if law enforcement was going to solve it, they had a crack. If forensics had the magic answer, we've seen that, and it didn't do it. So why not the armchair detective? And part of that, really, when you start getting into missing persons, it's sometimes an outsider coming in to ask the questions versus an authority figure, which in many communities is frowned upon. It is also sometimes years have passed, loyalties have shifted, people feel maybe more comfortable now answering questions they couldn't. Also, I would argue my favorite part of Frankie is I think her superpower is one of those ones that's just plain underrated in this day and age. She is a fabulous listener. She asks questions. She wants to know the answer, and she's not judging you for it. She herself has lived a marginalized life. She knows what this is like. And I feel, if anything, she's very timely in this day and age, where I would argue we're not always the best listeners. And I would imagine you must have so much training in interrogation. It is listening. It is not just asking the question, it's getting the answer.
That is true. It's funny because, I mean, I've taken many advanced interrogation courses, and people, lay people might think that, oh, it's all about, interrogation means you're asking questions. But in reality, a lot of the training is learning how to listen and, really importantly, learning how to create awkward pauses and weird silences and not interrupt them. That is like a whole art and skill to itself, you know, and I've seen it work, where you ask someone a question and then you wait and you wait and you wait. There is something in the human psyche that actually makes you want to fill the gap. It's really weird, but it is totally human nature, and you can't stand it, and you get twitchy, and you can see the person in front of you getting all twitchy because you've asked a really loaded question and it's hanging there, and they eventually feel really like, ooh, I better answer this, because if I don't, I look really guilty. Well, of course they do. And the other thing, too, that is a real skill when you're doing an interrogation is to ask, to make sure that the person that you're interviewing has no idea you know the answers to some questions and not others, and you call them on the ones that they're lying about, and then they don't know when you ask them a question, because most of the questions you already know the answer, and then they're like, oh, she's asking me that. Okay, does she know this? How much does she know? Does she know that? Oh, no. And you see them get all twitchy. And that's part of what you're doing. It has nothing to do with any kind of, like, horrible physical interrogation at all. It's really a mental thing.
Okay, so your husband's in law enforcement, too. So are domestic spats a lot of awkward silences where you see who breaks first?
Exactly. Many people, well, when they know the kind of stuff I write, which is really kind of dark, they ask my husband how he sleeps at night, and he says, with one eye open.
Yeah.
So would you tell us a little bit about the history? You and I, we were out drinking before this. I love what Isabella called it, socializing. Ha. But, anyway, we had a lovely time. But one of the things that Lisa was telling us about is the history of this island. We have sort of said Hawaii, but in point of fact, that's not accurate, yeah. Is it? So want to tell us all about it?
So my year of sabbatical, 30 years into writing, I wanted 1 year without a deadline. It's also possible my daughter went off to college and I was an empty nester, and I'm like, hello, if I can do whatever I want, I want to do whatever I want. So I had an opportunity through the Nature Conservancy to go to a place called the Palmyra Atoll. It is actually a research station. There's 12 people on it. That's it. So it's not populated. It's 3 hours outside of Hawaii by plane, 2 weeks by boat. And it's one of the interesting things in the history of Palmyra is it, weirdly enough, is not part of Hawaii. It was never included in the statehood documentations. So it is part of the United States, but it, weirdly enough, has like a dotted line straight to the federal government. So it does not fall under the, so we had to bring passports, not to go there, but we had to have a passport to come back in because we were in an unsecured border is how they viewed it. And actually when we were there, one of the things that had been discovered, and they, because ocean currents wash up everything, was a drug smuggling sub. Yeah, and then you start learning in the line, it's part of the Line Islands. There's all sorts of stuff that happens out there. So, but yeah, so Palmyra falls under directly like the U.S. federal, you know, so I had to ask questions about this. It would be the FBI that would go there because I was like, okay, so I'll, you know, have detectives. And they're like, no, it'd be the FBI. It is, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife who are managing it. So I was going there, frankly, in theory, to learn about ecological reclamation. They're doing some really wonderful work on how to save coral reefs and rejuvenate coral reefs. So just so you know, there's some really great stuff going on. But you land in this tiny, tiny little runway that only a small plane could even possibly bounce on. And no lights, no nothing. You're greeted in a golf cart. You go to this very rustic camp. I mean, there's no fresh water on the atoll. It's a cistern. There's no electricity. You're out there in the weeds now. And it's paradise, but it's paradise at 85% humidity, which within 48 hours, you really start to see how much paradise people can take at 85% humidity. There's a lot of rules governing social interactions because people might get a little testy at a remote atoll at 85% humidity. Like drinking is monitored. You're only allowed one drink. You have to be all ready to muster at a moment's notice. You are each other's backup. We had to sign medical forms before we came. They prefer it if you don't have an appendix. You know, we're told flat out, any medical emergency, you're 3 to 5 days. And it will be the U.S. Coast Guard that will have to come. And they have to get close enough by boat to send the chopper. And it could take a bit. So, that was the other big thing. You may not be allergic to a bee sting and be on there because they have some wasps and hornets. So that was one of the things. If you had that allergy at all, you were just prohibited. They're like, because we cannot, you know, testify to your safety. So, and so I get there, and this is supposed to be vacation. And it was, kind of, but I really don't like 85% humidity. And there was, in the book, you'll meet Wolfie, the wolf spider, who was in my cabin, who was. And then I had Krabby, whom I loved, who was my other roommate. But, yeah, 5 days in, our plane was supposed to come take us away, and there was a big storm, and the plane did not come and take us away because it could not land. And then it was like 4 days later, and the plane had the food. And really, you got to see, you know, Gilligan's Island has it all wrong. There's no professor making stuff with coconut. Can I just tell you that? But as this thing went on and on and on, I'm like, you really got to kill someone here. Sooner or later, we might. Oh, and then there's Crab Town, what crabs can do to remains. Forget the pigs. If I had known about crabs, the beautiful butcher would have had crabs. Yeah, that's how they composted there. And it was.
Crab teeth?
I don't know if they'll do teeth, but man, those crabs did. And there's literally, I don't know, it's got to be 200 of them crawling all over each other. And the compost and the coconut crabs are cannibals. Yeah, it's something else. Never mind. There's some videos online on social media if you'd like to go find them. We posted them over the weekend for National Crab Meat Day. Yeah, but It's one of those things on vacation. I'm on sabbatical. I'm not writing. And by the time I left this place, it's like, oh, you so, this is just so got to be a thriller novel. So what's inspired A Forgotten Kill? Because you used New York for a lot of evil in that.
Yeah.
Like block by block, you used New York
yeah.
for evil in that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. This one series is set in New York. The first series that I wrote is set in Phoenix. So all of you local Phoenix people, and I think that, yeah, they have some here at the Poison Pen of the first series.
We seem to have a somewhat yeah. erratic stock.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it comes back.
Isabella lives here.
I do.
You can always order anything, and yeah. she'll be happy to pop down and sign it for
yeah,
you. So
absolutely.
Don't let the fact that we don't always, the chain of supply is awkward sometimes.
It's sporadic a little, but yeah. So the first series was set here in Phoenix, and then the second series was out of Quantico. It was an FBI series, so it's kind of like more Virginia, but then it kind of went other places too. But then this series, I wanted to set it in New York City. So it's all in New York City. And yeah, I wanted to do it there. It's something like I've been to New York City so many times, I kind of fell in love with it. And I just abused everyone I know in New York for accurate information, because I've learned that New Yorkers are a rare breed and they are very possessive of their city. Any New Yorkers here? I'm just curious. Oh, yeah. Okay. Can we, there's always a couple.
Yeah.
But you get one thing wrong and they know it and they call you on it. So I had to actually go through all the areas of the city that I wrote about. I was on the subway and going through everything. And my poor agent is taking me everywhere around the city so that I can like literally video myself walking through so I can write the chase scenes and the fight scenes and everything else. But you know, you have to really be accurate with New York. But yeah, I had a lot of fun doing it, and I wanted to make sure I got all that stuff really accurate, and it was a great deal of fun.
Yeah, I swam with sea turtles. You be the judge whose process you want.
But you don't get the crazy people in the subway system, you know, accosting you and, I don't know, taking off their clothes and propositioning you and all kinds of other fun stuff that happens in New York City.
Who knows? You have to write in the National Guard if you're on the subway. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They do. They just
right.
called in the
they
National
have been
Guard.
Deployed oh to the God. Subway. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I won't be going back in the subway right now. You're right.
Are you going to be, you tend to write in trilogies, so is there going to be another one in this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is also going to be a trilogy, and I am currently writing the third book,
okay.
and that will be also a trilogy. Yeah, you're right.
I know. Wonderful.
And I'm working on the fourth, because this is the trilogy, right? This is what happens when you take a year off. It's like, I've written a book. I think there was some before then, but... Yeah, so, and actually, again, part of travel, you not only meet interesting places to kill people, you meet people who have interesting jobs. So on another one of my trips, I met a couple from Arizona who work as volunteers for resettling Afghan refugees in Tucson. And by the time they were done talking, welcome to Frankie Book 4 next year.
Local color, huh?
Yes, and it's making a good excuse for me to spend more time in Arizona, which given the weather in New Hampshire right now, yay you. Though I was here this summer and I was not so... yeah.
It was a one-off summer. 119 was just ghastly for, you know, one day maybe, but not for protracted days. But who knows how it's going to go. Yeah, it's we're all at the mercy of whatever the weather gods are doing. I blame it all on California. I frequently say that, but I mean, because most of our weather does come from California, but they're innocent in the, you know, the whole scheme of things. But that's really great news. But Isabella has another project that
yes.
we could tentatively measure, even if we don't have an actual date for it.
Tell us.
Oh, yeah, you're getting, okay, all right, you're getting me to tell all. Okay, so.
I already did, so you might as well tell us.
So there you go. All right, so I've just signed another book deal, and actually the book is being finalized, and it is coming out probably in August, and I am co-authoring a book with Jeffrey Deaver. You may remember him of Lincoln Rhyme fame, and of course, the Coulter Shaw series that is now the television show Tracker. That, you know, that is the Jeffrey Deaver. Yeah. So, So he and I are writing a book together. We created a whole new series, a whole new set of characters, and it's called the Sanchez and Heron series. So, she is a female DHS agent. And he is a professor who is what he calls an intrusionist, which is a made-up word that Jeffrey Deaver created. He's so good, right? But see, I can literally say that word and you can understand what it means, even though it doesn't exist. He's really good at making up words. And so, yeah, he came up with that word. And so, yeah, the two of them, they can't stand each other, but they do get forced to work together. And it is so cool. I am so excited about this. Yeah, the first book is all set, and we're busy getting ready. We're writing the second one to go with it, so it'll be a lot of fun.
Right. This was secret news when Jeffrey was here for his last book, which was a Lincoln Rhyme.
Yes.
I keep thinking it was Coulter Shaw. But anyway, Jeffrey's history with the poison pen goes all the way back for probably 34 years. He actually has come out just to celebrate my birthday, aside from anything else. I'm very fond of Jeffrey, a multi-award winning writer. So I'm happy that he and Isabella are doing something together. Have you ever thought about co-authoring something now that you're back off your sabbatical?
I don't know how to co-author. See, okay, so... Jeffrey
didn't think Jeffrey or Isabella did either.
Well, but in theory, Isabella and I talk about this all the time. Jeffrey Deaver is a renowned plotter, like very, very detailed outlines. So again, in the annals of writing, I am, you know, the direct opposite, perhaps enemy of, I am a pantser. I write by the seat of my pants. So if I never know what's going to happen next, I don't know how I could write it with
someone. That would be extremely difficult.
Yeah.
My favorite thing that Jeffrey ever said to me, some of you might have been here, we used to do it. Somebody asked him if he liked revising, and he said if they would let him, he would hang by his heels on a trapeze over the press while it was spinning and edit his book.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought that is so Jeffrey, right? You can just see him kind of doing it. But he's a perfectionist. But here's the thing. If you want to be a published author, at some point you actually have to let your book go. You know, regardless of whether you think it has reached the final stage of nirvana or whatever, at some point you do have to let it go so that it can be published, right?
I will argue, as a pantser, I have to revise a lot more.
Because when you write into corners.
Well, it's not that. It's when you get to page 399 out of 400 and you realize what the book's actually about. It helps if you sprinkle it through the book versus. But what I would also argue, so like in this particular book, was Still See You Everywhere, and I won't give anything away. There is a moment 3/4 of the way through the book where the scene just happened. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know who was going to do what to whom. And then the minute it happened, I was like, that person is entirely evil. And oh my God, that is so good. And those are the days as a writer where you're finally deliriously happy. We get like 3 a year. So, I mean, you really don't want to waste these things. And I'm just convinced if you have an outline, it's like you complete your book report, you turn it into the teacher. No, I want my day. I never saw that coming, but it was exactly what it should be. And the writing gods,
No, I will say because plotter and pantser are not ridiculous enough. I have another word for you. I'd call myself a plancer.
Oh, nice.
So kind of a hybrid between the two. I have like a plot all worked out and everything ahead of time. But sometimes when people ask me if I outline, you know, for my own books by myself, I would say, well, of course I outline. What else would I have to deviate from?
Yeah.
Invariably I do, you know, because it's like what you're saying, where you get way down into it and all of a sudden you're like, oh, that nirvana does happen, even if you're plotting ahead. And you're like, oh. And actually, I just had one of those moments yesterday working on the third book in this trilogy. And I've plotted it all out. And then I was going through and sort of refining the plot. And I've already written several of the chapters. And all of a sudden I went, wait a minute. Oh my gosh, I know what the bad guy's secret is. Because I like everyone to have a secret. You know, it really helps, because if you can sort of hold that in your mind as an author, you can get into the ulterior motives of what they're doing. And I'm like, I didn't know what his secret was, because you just don't want the cardboard mustache twirling baddie out there. He really does need a deeper motivation for the stuff he does. And especially, you know, for people like me that I write in his point of view, it's like, oh, now I know what his secret is. I didn't realize until I was well into it. So yeah, that can still happen, but yeah, it does unfortunately require some more rewriting than needs to be would anticipate. But
so
yeah,
you've heard it all here first, folks. The secret to happiness, if you're an author, is to have the voices in your head of people you've never met and don't exist not only have secrets from you but from themselves. And then we can sleep at night.
Right, so authors are never actually having dinner by themselves. They're generally surrounded by other people and voices. You're never lonely, are you?
We're never lonely. Are you ever lonely? I'm never lonely.
Now, do you also wake up in the middle of the night and make notes? Because I do.
I may wake up in the middle of the night and I do the bullet points in my head, and then I remember them in the morning.
Oh, I do not remember them. I'm famous for, I don't want to wake my husband up. So, I mean, like I've heard some writers say, oh, they get up and turn on the light and write that. No, that's not going to happen. So what I do is I get my phone and I'll send emails to myself.
Ah, nice. Yeah.
I do, with these weird notes. And I get them the next morning and I'm like, wow, you know, I don't remember that, but I'm really glad I sent the email. Cause yeah, unlike you, I wouldn't remember it the next day.
Every now and then I'll turn one of the three dogs on the bed and say, hey, in the morning, tell me this. But you know they don't. They're a little bit slackers, I gotta be honest. Every now and then I'm like, you gotta do more than look cute for your cookies. Come on now.
We all love Mr. Beans.
Yeah. Thank you. But they're all great hiking partners, and hiking is how I problem solve. So if I'm a pantser and I don't know what's gonna happen next, and I don't know what's gonna happen to Frankie now that she's on a remote atoll with 12 strangers and they're all keeping secrets, but they're all being told they should trust one another because they depend upon one another. It's the hiking is where I work everything out. It's a form of what we call active meditation. How do you problem solve your books?
I also do. I like the active meditation. I do that too, where I walk and walk and walk. And then also sometimes I am well known for this, and I don't know if this happens to you, but I get called out for it all the time. I'm sitting like at the dinner table or at a gathering and I'm staring into the distance. And then people will be like, Isabella, Bella,
yeah,
Bella, you know, I am thinking, and sometimes I do have the 1,000-yard stare,
yeah,
and
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
off. My mind is totally somewhere else. That does happen. And it's nothing personal to all the people I love who come to my house, but yeah.
So, okay, so for myself, I get up early and I like to write early, like the sun may or may not be up. Partly because once you get to be at a level of the authors we are, there's all this other stuff we have to do for our business, from social media to contracts to blah, 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 to blah, blah, blah. So before the phone rings and the real world can find you is always the perfect time to write. So I try to get out, you know, we'll say a chapter or 5 to 10 pages. And then it's like, okay, the dogs and I will go for a walk. And in that moment, I realize everything I did wrong. And possibly I wrote myself into a corner. Thank you, Barbara. It's kind of you to bring that up. And then in the afternoon, I try to fix some things. So what's a day in the life of Isabella Maldonado?
Well, see, now you have relieved yourself of the burden of a child at home.
It was a good thing to do, yeah. I got to be honest.
we were talking about that also over our, well, I'm still going to say it was socializing.
Yeah, we were socializing.
But yeah, so, but my son is still just a freshman in high school. So I've got 4 more years of high school to go through before he, you know, he's off to college. But yeah, your daughter's already. So I just have like a limited amount of time till he gets up, and then, you know, I have to deal with that before he goes off to school. Then I do have time in between to do things, but there's a lot of interruptions. But then when he's home from school, I do kind of have to engage and things like that. So it does tend to get chunked up with my kid. But my writing has always been around him, in the sense that I did not write my very first novel until he was in kindergarten, because I kind of needed to be there on hand all the time, the stay-at-home mom and everything, so it wasn't even until he was in kindergarten at 5 years old that I wrote my very first novel. And so that's kind of, yeah, it's all been around that.
Yeah, and I wrote my very first novel at 17 because I'm a freak of nature, and I did not have the fortitude or wherewithal to spend 20 years in law enforcement. Now I just interview those people and ask them, hey, tell me about a cool case you worked on. Great, we're good.
No, you can't top that. Maybe you should ask for questions from the audience.
Yes, we should. We should. All right, already. Yes.
So
did you read Lone Wolf?
I was here. I got to meet him for Lone Wolf.
Oh, now she's just bragging.
So I had never heard of him before. So
Greg Hurwitz, sorry. Him is Greg Hurwitz.
What are you ladies reading now?
Oh, so I'll go first on this one just because I have a mad author crush right now. And also a new book out, Simone St. James.
All right. Here on Friday, and whose book we sold out on Friday.
Yes, wow. Murder Road. So, so, so good. So if you like Riley Sager at all, thrillers with a hint of the supernatural. So I had not read her till they sent me Murder Road to quote on. And I love that so much. Then I had to go back and I had to reread all of her books. And November for me was just a Simone St. James binge fest, which, let's be honest, if you're a reader, how fun is that? Yeah, so just, you know, that's my, okay, you liked Greg Hurwitz, now Simone St. James.
And just wait, I'm going to pause. Greg Hurwitz will be here on May 6th to launch Mark Sullivan's
yes.
new book.
Yes, and Mark's book, so, so good.
Beneath yeah. the Scarlet Sky, and he has, so we're gonna have a big publication.
Yeah, and
thing,
I have the
Greg
new one at
be
home,
here
and
for
I can't
that.
Picture it for Love Nor Money. The new historical.
Yeah,
the title.
Set in Uganda. I can't remember either.
Yeah. It's really good. Just take our word for that.
I haven't gotten it yet. Right. Patrick is going to emerge from his lair and probably has a couple of questions from the virtual audience, but we can go on and
wait,
take...
Wait, Isabella's just answered this.
Oh, sorry.
I forgot.
That's okay.
No, actually, I am... Right now, I'm reading Nick Petrie, has
yes,
a new one
so
coming
good.
Out with
so
a
good.
Peter Ash series. And actually, it's funny you mention Greg Hurwitz because I'm actually going to be on a panel with Greg Hurwitz and Nick Petrie and Amanda Flowers on, and you can all watch, it's going to be on a live streamed Rogue Women Writers on the 18th, so in next week. So yeah, if you're like addicted to any of them, so yeah, we're
that's
all going to
be a killer panel.
Yeah, it's
going to
be an awesome panel. We're all four going to be together, so that'll be a lot of fun.
I will say that Burning Bright, which is Nick's second book, Nick Petrie's second book, has the best opening chase scene I have ever read.
Yeah, I love
I
Peter
still
Ash.
Say that
that's
it
another
is
good
the
one.
Best
yeah.
chase scene ever. So it's out in paperback. Probably, you know, I keep mentioning books. We don't actually have them here to sell, but we can get them. But I'm really serious. I think it is truly brilliant.
Yeah.
I like all his books. I think he has a wonderful voice. I like the character, but
he's a really good writer and a very nice person, as is Greg. But the other thing is kind of funny, and we were talking about this earlier, that that the Peter Ash character that he writes is the stranger that came to town, and you know, it is that same motif, but it's done beautifully.
And I mean, it goes without saying, you guys are all watching Real Trent, right? I don't have to educate you on that. Okay, good. So, you know, because Karen's amazing and you should all, Will Trent. Okay, good. All done. All right. Patrick.
I don't have her August date yet, sorry, but she will be here in August. I can actually tell you what we're doing on September 3rd. Right.
Yes. In the back. I have some thoughts. Oh, yeah, we need to repeat the question because we're being taped. Will there be more Dee Dee Warren and Flora Dane? I do have thoughts on that subject. Stay tuned.
Okay.
Pink.
So,
Dee Dee
Warren,
yeah.
who was, like, arguably one of the best characters ever.
I love you.
I loved her. Obviously, she lived with you for quite a while, right, because you wrote several books. Where did she come from?
Okay, so Dee Dee Warren, where did she come from? Because I, you know, had this whole life with her, and then I don't know if she left me or I left her, but it's been sad. You know, I joke a lot as writers. It might not be quite as much for you, but we write our alter egos. And Dee Dee Warren for me was, it was a walk-on part for this book alone that was really about a a police sniper, and they said, oh, for this particular scene, it would actually be a Boston cop, not a state cop. And I had this image of this incredibly aggressive, confident, workaholic, almost abrasive, but, you know, admirably so, kind of. And it was, she was like in two chapters of Alone, and it went ballistic. My editor, readers, everyone was like, we want her. And I'm like, well, that was the most fun I ever had writing a character. So yeah, let's do her. Yeah. You know, everyone's like, is there any of you in Dee Dee Warren? I'm like, no. She's everything I want to be when I grow up, though. And honestly, when we write books, you know, you're spending a lot of time with these people, spending a lot of time with everyone who's, you know, says all the things you were raised to be too polite to ever say, can eat all the food I can't eat, can go all the places. Like, I mean, I really do miss her. I can't even tell you.
Andrew, do you need a mic?
Yeah, probably do.
Oh.
Okay, get out of the way of the camera. Let's see. So, yeah, question for Bella. Robin says, I'm looking forward to the cipher on the screen. Will it be a film or TV?
Okay, so one of my books, The Cipher, has been optioned by Netflix to be made into a feature film starring Jennifer Lopez, J-Lo. And so, yeah, that's very exciting. But yeah, it is for a feature film rather than a series. And so we will see. It's kind of, you know, you have to wait. She's a busy lady. So yeah, we have to find a slot on her busy schedule.
Okay, so here's my thing. So Netflix did such a great job with Mark Graney's books, you know, that it's like, please let them do that for this as well with J-Lo. That would be awesome.
I'm sure she's gonna make sure that it's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ben's not gonna be in it, is he?
I don't know.
Are there Dunkin' Donuts in the movie? Or maybe he can do the opening song now that he has a new gig.
All right, here's one for you, Lisa. Dana, what power do you have in the choice of audio readers? Lisa, do you actually know Kirsten Potter? Why did you change to Hillary Huber for Frankie? Was it to have a different voice, quite literally? For the record, I love them both, but I'm curious.
Oh, so that was a long question, but you've got it recorded for us. So, yes, actually, Dana's assumption is correct. We did change from Kirsten Potts to Hillary Huber, who I adore, for Frankie, because different characters, a different voice. Authors have input, but really the audio publisher comes to you with what we call talent. And they'll give you a few choices, listen to these readers. Love Kristen. And then when they brought us Hillary for Frankie, she was fantastic. You can follow her on social media at Hillary Out Loud. She just finished She'll See You Everywhere. And it's once, especially if you're doing a series character, being able to keep that relationship, because particularly for the audio experiencers, she is Frankie's voice. So it's fabulous to have that continuity.
How about you, Bella? Are you happy with your audio readers?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is the same thing where they come to you. And I was super impressed with my publisher because they made it a point to make sure that the readers were ethnically appropriate. So they had Latina readers doing the Latina lead characters. And in the in this series, it's kind of like they're... I was able to get them to do two readers. And so one is the Latina lead, which is Daniela Vega. And the other one is an Asian American narrator who plays the role of Steve Wu, who is the SAC, the FBI SAC in charge of the New York City JTTF. I know I'm spouting out all these things, but it's a cop thing. But anyway, I was just so impressed that they actually made sure that they got talent that was representing. And I love that. And I think they both just absolutely knocked it out of the park. I've loved all of my narrators. And yes, like you, different narrators for different series.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Let's see. Dana has one more question, which is for both of you guys. Please share your thoughts about multiple perspectives in a novel. Is having multiple perspectives a sound literary strategy? I suspect she's probably an aspiring writer.
Okay. Well, Dana, I'm going to give you the advice no one wants to hear. It's right when you know it's right. I've written books with a lot of multiple point of views. Frankie books are first person only. I will argue for me, she is much harder to write. It's nicer to have multiple point of views, kind of changes things up and keeps the pacing going more naturally. But a story needs to be told the way a story needs to be told. And I think you will agree. That's one of the advantages of writing multiple books, is you start to feel that out and know this is what this needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do like writing multiple, and because I do like changing up the point of view. And it's kind of interesting in A Killer's Game, the one that came before this, there's one point of view that is like a mystery through the whole book all the way till the end. And it was kind of fun because with the narration, they did it through a voice synthesizer. To keep the mystery.
Nice.
Yeah.
Was it in italics?
No, because no. What I do is I do like short chapters. Each chapter is a different point of view. So I was just able to keep it in one chapter. But I love, and I actually asked them, I'm like, please, you know, do something different because this is supposed to be the mystery person. And they totally came through. It was
That's
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Anyone else?
Yeah. So the question is, so I have Dee Dee Warren, I have the FBI profilers, characters Kimberly, now I have Frankie. In the past, I've had books where they've all come together. Is there a possibility of that in the future? And are you talking to my editor? How do you know these things? But I don't know about you, but for me, my characters become a little bit like my children, and who doesn't want all their children in one room? And also, as a huge reader who likes series characters and various authors' characters, I mean, I think Karen Slaughter has a whole, you know, menagerie of characters. You now have this huge stable of characters. Why pick and choose if you can just get them all together? And it's kind of fun to see them play off one another. And it's a good challenge for me. So, yes, all I can tell you is stay tuned. Boston's going to become very crowded one of these years.
Wow, we really ought to end on that. How can we go any better? So let's thank both our authors and congratulate them at the same time.
Thank you all for coming tonight.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.